It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to, lots to talk about. Space Day! Yes, today it's all about a rich guy going to space. It's all about a rich guy and his toys. It's all about a rich guy spending his money. And look, his money, they say. You know, it's his money. You should be able to do what he wants. You shouldn't be upset about that. We should celebrate the fact that we got three rich guys who are competing to see who can get their phallic symbol into the sky as high and as far as possible. Yeah, that's what we're supposed to do, you know. And look, you had a bunch of people who were thrilled about it, you know, because look, I love things going to space. Want to go myself. Would love to be able to do it at some point. Never going to be able to afford a ticket. Not going to happen. But today it was all about the rich guy going to space. He was very happy. Had a very nice conversation about how happy he was. Yeah. So that was the news. And it's just one of those things that just, I'm looking at it just in this most angry of tones and thoughts. But I'll be honest, my first thought was he's going to space for 10 minutes. And I think it was 10 minutes and 10 seconds is how long he spent in orbit. So the whole ride, you know, gazillions of, who knows how much it cost. 10 minutes, 10 seconds. And my first thought was, I wonder if the Amazon employees get to go to the bathroom now. I wonder if, you know, I wonder if Amazon gave them a break so that they could watch Dear Leader go into space. So my mind is going in all these places. Did they get to partake in it? Because after all, and again, this is one of those weird kind of moments where you go, well, you know, after all, the good workers, you know, they did pay for this after all. You know, it was their blood, sweat, and tears. And in fact, you know, even Dear Leader himself, the gall, to well.
And then I want to thank every Amazon employee and every Amazon customer, because you guys paid for all of this. So seriously, for every Amazon customer out there and every Amazon employee, thank you from the bottom of my heart very much.
Yeah, from the bottom of his heart. Now, you stop and think about this. He's right. He was a moment of candor, a moment of honesty. The lower wages, the diminished benefits, the constant high-stress work environment, the lack of retirement security, down the list. Paid for all of it. You could also go into the fact that we have a tax code that decided that massive tax breaks for people like Jeff Bezos are more important than, you know, paving our roads and fixing our bridges and educating our children and getting health care for our citizens, and all down the list. And it was one of these just kind of moments where I couldn't help but be kind of angry. And this is one of those things, well, you know, and I had someone go, well, you're just jealous because, you know, he was able to do this. I go, no, it's not jealousy. This is someone who could literally, because of the power that he has, save humanity. He could have that legacy. And instead, the only legacy he's going to have is the rich guy with toys, where him and Branson and Musk are playing with their rockets. And you go, but, you know, it's a good thing, you know, because we need to do other things. We need to explore space. How about we fix here? How about we take some of that resource and that engineering know-how and some of that power and figure out how we save this planet? Just kind of a thought. Now, Jim Sciutto, the reporter, tweeted out, "What's better than a rocket countdown?" And, you know, I look at that and I go, nothing. Look, I love the fact that we're shooting stuff into space. You know, the environment be damned. Because maybe someday, in a couple hundred years, we'll figure out how to colonize the moon or Mars, or we'll figure out a use for it. Maybe in a couple hundred years, but not now. And the thing that was interesting to me is everyone was like, you know, he's just trying to figure out how to escape. I'm going, no, I don't see that. He's not trying to escape the planet, because living on the space station, reading some of the accounts of what it takes to live in the space station, nobody wants to do that for a long period of time. That's not escape. That's prison. That's a constant regiment of you know, all kinds of, you know, eating habits and bathroom habits. And there's nothing fun for a long period of time in that. So they're not escaping. This is just because they can't. And, you know, to Shudo's point, you know, what's better than a rocket countdown? You know, how about a pay raise for the workers there at Amazon? For the people who he admitted paid for the event. How about some dignity and respect outside of, oh, hey, thank you. I mean, I wish someone would just walked up to him and slapped him right there. Because that's just, I don't know, to me, just obnoxious. So then you go down the list of what is better than a rocket countdown. You know, how about decent health security? How about a decent pension? How about opportunities? How about education? How about kids not having to go into debt for a lifetime? Because we've decided that one guy should have, you know, gazillions of dollars that he can, you know, play with his rockets and buy giant, you know, enormous yachts that, you know, $500 million. Now, how about we talk about things like safe working conditions? Because all we did today, all we saw in the media today was how incredible Jeff Bezos' 10 minutes into space was. Not one story about the strikes that are going on across this country. Not one story about the struggling families that are worried about paying their rent. Not one story about how the $250 child tax money that's coming out is helping families to put food on the table. None of that stuff, because none of that's important. We need the shiny thing. We need something to distract us. And understand, we've got three rich guys because of our tax code. Because of supply-side voodoo Reaganomics, a Republican Party hell-bent on starving the beast, making government so small we can drag it in the bathtub and drown it in the bathtub, so that these handful of, you know, very wealthy people can now play with their toys. And we pay for it. Again, through lower wages, less health care, less retirement security, diminished opportunities, you know, higher costs for education. Go down the list. We pay for all this stuff. And yet we're never going to get to be able to ride on these ships. They're like, oh, well, you know, the Bezos' ticket was really cheap. It was only $28 million. It's crazy. And yet, you know, I don't think I saw enough outrage. You know, there was some on Twitter. People were upset saying, look, you know, we've got starving kids. We've got things that we need better. We need better opportunities. We need all kinds of stuff. And look, I woke up this morning knowing this was going to happen. You know, I woke up this morning and basically asked, you know, who's ready for the love fest that's coming? Who's ready to hear about how wonderful Jeff Bezos is and how fantastic that he is, that he took the oldest person into space and the youngest person? You know, because we got to do that stuff now. Not the most qualified. So what was this today, other than a vanity moment? Hey, look what I can do. Was there anything that came out of this? Was there any scientific research? Were there any experts, you know, taking, you know, some bits of air? Or was there anything positive other than, hey, we can do it, and we're going to do it again, and we're going to do it multiple times? And you go, for what purpose? Oh, we're just going to go back and forth. Dumb. And I had a couple of people say, well, you know, it's his money. He can do what he wants with it. And I agree with that to a degree. Once you start paying your taxes, and this is a guy who pays lower rates of taxes than most average working people. There is something wrong with that. Fundamentally wrong with that. The kind of outweighted power that these handful of gazillionaires have is not good for democracy. Now, I know we all like to believe that we're going to be the next Jeff Bezos. We're going to go and we're going to tinker in our garage and we're going to come up with the next who know what machine. And it's going to revolutionize whatever and we're all going to be gazillionaires. I know we feel that way. I like to believe someday I'm going to be rich too. And then I can pay the 95% tax rate that the wealthy had to pay back during World War II. And be proud of it. And that's the weird thing. This is the weird time that which we live in. You know, someone said today, you know, Ronald Reagan was a great man. You know, he brought down the Soviet Union. He brought down communism. He single-handedly. I'm going, no, he spent them into disaster. We basically ran ourselves into massive debt so that the Soviet Union would spend a ton of money on weapons. And it was who's going to collapse first? And it just happened to be the Soviet Union was involved in Afghanistan for a gazillion years. And they were spending more money on bullets and bombs than they were on guns and butter. And absolutely, they end up falling. And you go, think about where we are. I mean, this is one of those moments where was this the nation's wealth best spent? And I say Jeff Bezos was a billionaire made on a great crime. Behind every good billionaire, there's a crime. And I believe that. And Bezos's crime was he figured out how to cheat states out of taxes. That's what gave him the competitive edge. And for years got away with not paying state taxes. And lobbied to keep it that way. And still in a lot of places, it's like that. And here we are in this moment where we can't get an infrastructure bill passed through. Because one side's saying, well, you know, we're broke. We don't have any money. And you know why we don't have any money? Because that side has spent all of their years figuring out how to make the next Jeff Bezos, the next handful of them, at the expense of the working people who did the work. I mean, the fact that Bezos actually had the audacity to thank his workers. Thank you, workers. Thank you, peons. Thank you, dimwits. Thank you for the lower wages that you were willing to accept. And thank you for the less health care. And thank you for you know, being able to be exploited and stressed into working, you know, 10, 12, 14 hours. Thank you for, you know, not taking breaks. Thank you for all of that.
And then I want to thank every Amazon employee and every Amazon customer, because you guys paid for all of this.
You paid for it all. And you're going to pay for what's coming next. And what's coming after that and what's coming after that. And you know what? You're going to get nothing out of it. And that's the sad part. Because look, you could argue, but Rick, you know, when we sent the man up to the moon back in the 60s, you could have made the same argument that we were wasting, you know, government resources, we were wasting dollars that we could have spent on poverty programs and all the things that you're talking about. And you're right. We could have, but out of that space program came just unimaginable research and new products and all kinds of stuff. What did today really get us? As a nation, if you're talking about an investment, what did this get us? Did this move us closer to understanding space? Did this get us any closer to doing anything constructive other than just feeding an ego? I don't know, man. Is this the right thing? Am I on the wrong track? Is this something we want to encourage? Are we waiting for the next billionaire to go, no, we're going to take a couple of people up and we're going to make a big deal and the news is going to be all gaga and give us all kind of fluff pieces and all kind of old accolades and oh, how wonderful and how smart and how good we are. Is that what we need? Look, I love the idea of rallying around a space program. When they put the rover up on Mars, I'm like, this is incredible because that's scientific. We're doing something. We're trying to figure something out. This was just, again, I go back to just for vanity. This was just because, hey, look what I can do. I am going to put my name into the record books. But sadly, the other billionaire beat him there. Richard Branson got there first. No flag to stake in the ground, sadly, because they didn't actually get out. They just went up and came back down. And couldn't we have used that for a better purpose? Couldn't we have used the resources in a better way? Because understand, and this is where I come back to the supply side voodoo ragged argument. We're told that giving all of the resources, all the money to the very wealthy, they're smart. They know what to do with it. They're going to spend it constructively and building new industries and new jobs and all of this stuff. Did this move us closer? Did this investment by we the people, because we paid for it, he's right. In a brief moment of candor and honesty, he was right. We paid for it. Did this move us any closer to something positive? Did this move us forward? And I would argue, no, it didn't. And what we've ended up with is just a rich guy who, hey, you know, look what I did. And look what I'm going to do again. Now, was it great that, you know, the 92-year-old, I think 92-year-old was it great that that happened? Yeah, I thought that was pretty cool. I think it's pretty cool that the 18-year-old kid got to go too, because somebody had a scheduling conflict. They spent $28 million and oops, had a scheduling conflict. Had to catch my kid's soccer game. Sorry, just ruined it. Needed to get my bikini wax. You know, maybe should have bought trip insurance. I don't know. But something, you know, it's just crazy. And again, you know, what kind of conflict, scheduling conflict, would make you go, it's only $28 million? I'd love to hear your thoughts. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. More American than workers standing up. And the union gives a voice to win. On the Rick Smith Show. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1934. That was the day that came to be known as Bloody Friday. Minneapolis Teamsters had been on strike for 3 days in their third strike of the year. Trucking bosses had reneged on their May settlement. They refused to recognize union organization of inside workers. In the period between strikes, the union had documented hundreds of cases of discrimination. Now, 7,000 Teamsters effectively shut down trucking throughout the city. Local 574 leaders established a daily strike bulletin. The organizer, as it was called, would serve to guide strikers to victory. In his book, Revolutionary Teamsters, historian Brian Palmer notes that the first few days of the strike had been quiet. Then, on this day, police attempted to break the picket lines by running what seemed to be a lone scab truck through the line. It was later discovered the truck was moving no merchandise, but was used to draw strikers into a confrontation. When flying pickets moved to stop the truck, they were ambushed. Police opened fire on unarmed picketers and then sprayed those who attempted to escape with buckshot. At least 48 were wounded. Striker Harry Ness and unemployed council supporter John Beller were killed. Palmer notes that Ness had been shot point blank in the chest. Doctors pulled 38 slugs from his body. His deathbed injunction repeated word of mouth among the strikers, "Tell the boys not to fail me now." More than 40,000 turned out to pay their respects to the World War I veteran and father of four. Palmer adds that Bloody Friday had lasted a matter of minutes, but its meaning would leave a mark on the very fabric of Minneapolis's socioeconomic relations. Labor History in 2 brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and the Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So this week, labor is pulling out all the stops to highlight the fact that we need major major labor law reform in this country. And all across the country, groups are holding rallies, telling horror stories of horrible working conditions, explaining why now is the time we need action. Now is the time we need to make it easier for people to join and form unions. And now is the time we need to hold employers accountable. And here to share some thoughts on this week of action on why the PRO Act, the Protect the Right to Organize Act, is so greatly needed. I've asked Tim Schlittner to come talk with us. Tim is the communications director there at the AFL-CIO. Tim, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick. Good to be with you, as always.
So, big week. I'm seeing events all across the country, tour buses, all kinds of stuff, highlighting the fact that we desperately need this this PRO Act to get passed through. Tell me what you're seeing.
Yeah, it's a big week in a big year for the PRO Act. There's just a groundswell out there of understanding that the labor laws we currently have do not allow workers to form unions freely and fairly. There's 60 million workers who want to join or form a union, but they're not being able to do it. They're being blocked by outdated laws, by corporate lawyers and anti-union tactics in the workplace that are designed to scare people from exercising their right and their will. And there's just a growing recognition, both inside and outside the labor movement, in blue and in red states, that the right to form a union is fundamental. It'll help change the direction of our economy so it's fairer, and it'll help save our democracy. So there's just a real excitement around the PRO Act. This week there's going to be an event at all 100 senators' offices out in the country. So there's just a real momentum for this bill right now.
No, it's something that's absolutely needed. And look, I think, you know, the guy who was all over the news today because he shot his little rocket into the sky and came back down, and they spent $200 million fighting off a unionization effort in a right-to-work state, where they could have easily broken that down the road. The sad reality is they've got so much power, so much resource, and the labor laws are so badly broken that we desperately need this reform.
Yeah, he's going into space, and the people that work for him are peeing in bottles because they're too afraid to take a break working for the richest man in the world and one of the most profitable companies in the world. There's just something awfully wrong with that. The election that RWDSU-UFCW had in Alabama was just the perfect example of how broken our labor laws are. Amazon cheated every step of the way in that campaign. Workers weren't able to freely and fairly express their voice in that election. We see that across industries, across states, and it's just time. It's time to get back to the original intent of the National Labor Relations Act, passed all the way back in 1935, and that is to encourage collective bargaining so people can negotiate for better wages, benefits, and working conditions.
Yeah, so no, here's the thing. My lifetime, Democrats have broken my heart time and time again. When I was a little kid, there was talk of Carter undoing Taft-Hartley. Bill Clinton swore we were going to get strike replacement. I shook Barack Obama's hand twice. He told me we're getting something better than the Employee Free Choice Act. Here we are at this moment, probably further along in the process of getting something than we've had in my lifetime. What are the chances?
Well, you know, Rick, I'm a Knicks fan, so I've lived with a broken heart basically all of my adult life. Those other opportunities with Carter and Clinton and Obama, those were terribly disappointing, heartbreaking, and the labor movement and our allies poured our hearts into those moments, and we came up short. This time has to be different. I think it can be different. I think this president is more committed to the labor movement and to labor law reform than any of his recent Democratic predecessors. I think the country's in a different place than it was in the late 70s, the mid 90s, and 2009. I think there's a growing recognition that unionism is a solution not only for our economic challenges, but for issues like addressing climate change responsibly, saving our democracy, racial justice, voting rights. They can all be strengthened with a stronger labor movement. So I think the combination of the country and the president and with the will of the labor movement and our allies, we can get it done this time. But it's not done till it's done.
Right.
So until those points are on the board, we're not going to stop. We're not going to rest. A week of action will be another week of action, will be a month of action, will be a year of action. We will not rest.
So one of my great fears is that it's already being watered down while we're speaking. I, you know, I just read something a little bit ago that said that they've already watered it down and they're only now going after the economic penalties and a couple of other things to get past the Senate parliamentarian. Obviously, you're closer to this than most of us. What are you hearing?
Well, the bill hasn't been changed, right? The bill that passed the House stands. It is sitting in the Senate. It has 47 co-sponsors. We're working really hard to get 50 co-sponsors. Then there's another track that's moving in the Senate, the budget resolution, which is moving through something called reconciliation. It's a technical process term, but it's related to the budget. And I know a lot of our champions on the Hill, like Bernie Sanders and others who want the PRO Act badly, are just looking for any improvements to workers' rights that we can get into that budget resolution. That would be a positive. If we can get improvements to workers' rights, penalties on corporations that union bust into the budget resolution this year, all the better. But that's not a substitute for the PRO Act. The PRO Act would repeal right to work. It would ban striker replacement. It would guarantee first contract arbitration. It would completely change the scope of labor relations in America so workers have a fair chance. That only can be accomplished through the full PRO Act, and we're committed to passing that bill.
Now, do you think the chances of getting that through reconciliation are possible? And look, there's never going to be a way, in my view, and you can disagree, that we're going to get 60 votes. You're never getting 10 Republicans to come along, in my view. I don't even think you're going to get one, but that's another argument. The only way I see this getting through is through the budget reconciliation process. And even then, I'm a little concerned at the likes of Kelly Sinema, or I don't know why Kristen Sinema and Joe Manchin.
You're combining two of our targets, Mark Kelly and Kristen Sinema, into Kelly Sinema, which exactly. I like. We are in very good dialogue with Lisa Murkowski, the Republican senator of Alaska. Congressman Don Young of Alaska, also a Republican, voted for the PRO Act. So we think she's very much in play. As far as getting to 60 votes, I agree that it's unlikely. We're really focused on getting 50 and then pushing for the Senate to make a change to the rules. So the will of the people, the things that the American people voted for in the 2020 election, can go through. Yeah. If we can get any of it passed in the budget reconciliation, that's fine. But again, we need the full PRO Act.
No, and this is one of those things where, you know, I say that we can't get to 60 because I know the political realities of where we are. But I have a lot of Republican friends who are the most staunch union members, the most solid union members you're going to meet. And they can't figure out why their party will not support organized labor, will not support something like the PRO Act that is going to make it easier for people to join unions and secure their jobs. Look, you know, it's one thing to have a union job right now, but if you're not increasing your density, if you're not increasing the members, especially in your industry, you're going to struggle. And I know a lot of Republican voters who are like, you know, why can't Republicans support sane, rational labor law reform like this?
I couldn't agree more. I think it's crazy. There's a lot of Republican union members. There was Republican legislators that helped block attacks on union rights this year in New Hampshire and Montana and Florida because they knew that their constituents would be upset if union rights were rolled back. So I think that the National Republican Party, which has just taken an extremely anti-union position over the decades, is badly out of touch with the rank and file Republican voter. And we welcome both the rank and file Republican voter, rank and file Democratic voter to join us in pressuring all 100 senators to pass the PRO Act. That's what this week of action is about.
Yeah, because I get this all the time from people. You know, whenever I talk about union stuff, you get people going, well, they only support Democrats. And I go, because there's nobody else. Yeah, I was talking to a guy the other day, and he goes, well, I don't like Tom Wolf. And I go, well, Tom Wolf's the only reason that Pennsylvania is not a right-to-work state. And he goes, really? And I go, yeah, the only reason. And he goes, well, I'm going to have to rethink that. And this is where I think the messaging that comes out of this is we got to hold people accountable for not supporting labor law reform.
I think that's absolutely right. There was a poll out of Arizona today that showed 65% of likely voters support the PRO Act. There's an election in Arizona in 2022. Mark Kelly is up. There's an election in 2024. Kristen Sinema is up. It's really important that they listen to their constituents on this one because we just can't have more of the same. We can't have another round of disappointments, another round of wait, and we'll get to the labor law reform. because we've been through this story too many times. The labor movement is not growing. The country is suffering because of it, and the PRO Act would change that.
Yeah. Now, today, the big news, obviously, was Jeff Bezos and his brother and the oldest person to go into space and the youngest person to go into space. And I'm not really sure on what the point was. I don't know that we did anything positive. I think it was just a rich guy going, hey, look what I can do with my toys. My question is, did the Amazon workers get to watch Dear Leader go into space? Did they at least get that 10-minute break?
You know, that's a good question. I have to wonder if they did, they maybe got docked in their pay for it. But, you know, it's just the rich in this country, the super rich especially, and people like Jeff Bezos who have used his wealth to deny working people rights on the job. This economy has been tilted toward them for so long that it's just become normal. We've become numb to it. And what we saw today, again, was just rich people doing rich things while working people are down on earth, moving this country, serving it, building it, and not having a proper voice in our economy. And that's just a shame. It's got to stop. And I think we finally have the momentum and the recognition to stop it.
Yeah, but, you know, here's the thing. I mean, even in his weird little moment of candor he had today, he admitted, you know, hey, thanks to all my employees for paying for this.
Well, again, yeah, I heard that, but you can say thank you by allowing your workers to form a union. That's the best thanks you can give, and that should be done down here on Earth.
Yeah, I'm right there with you. But at the end of the day, you know, when you start looking at our laws, and this comes back to the people that we elect and the policies that they pursue, we have a tax code that is heavily suited towards the very wealthy and punishing people who work. And we have labor laws that have been so badly broken over the years that the only tool that workers have to be able to fight back has been basically rendered almost impossible to use. We're at this moment where something has to get done.
I agree. And a lot of this, Rick, has happened on the Democratic Party's watch. And I think it's the Democratic Party has a responsibility to clean it up.
Yeah.
I know this president wants to do it. And we really need those in his party and every like-minded Republican that supports workers to join them in doing it and doing it now.
Yeah. What do you think of Biden's first couple of months? Where are we putting him right now? Are we happy with things, or could things move a little quicker? I wish the infrastructure plan would move a lot faster, but I'm curious your thoughts.
I think it's been a tremendous start. I think the way he's handled COVID-19, getting his arms around that, getting the American Rescue Plan passed, there was $80 billion for pensions to shore up our pensions that were in danger of going bankrupt, getting money into people's pockets, getting vaccines into people's arms. Now the infrastructure plan, you know, the push for America to build, not just talk about infrastructure, but to actually build infrastructure. And obviously the PRO Act and the American Families Plan, getting money so families can have a secure foundation and thrive in this economy. I think it's a very strong start, but only a start.
No, and we need to get the infrastructure bill pushed through. We need to get that moving. We need to get people into jobs. We need to rebuild our infrastructure. We need to build for the future. And look, you know, I'm not against investing into going into space. If today's trip with Bezos going up would have had a purpose, I wouldn't be so critical of it. But I think we could have used that money in a much, much better way.
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more on infrastructure. We're lagging behind the world. This has been something that's been talked about in Washington for a long, long time, but nothing gets done. There's press conferences, there's weeks, there's panels, there's pictures, but we need to start, you know, laying the groundwork and build and rebuilding America. And I think infrastructure will pass this year. And it's just long overdue.
Although I got to tell you, you know, the former guy, when he was in the White House, we had like infrastructure week, like every week. And there were always really great photo ops of him hiding behind trucks or yelling at kids while cutting grass. Never got anything done, but there were some fun photo ops that came out of that.
Yeah, there really was. I mean, the whole presidency was absurd memes and photo ops. But again, we never built. We never passed an infrastructure bill. And it's like, it's the same old thing. It's Groundhog Day. I feel like Bill Murray. We have to build. We have to do it. And I think finally now we're going to get infrastructure passed.
Yeah, I'm hopeful, but yeah, I got to tell you, there's still that moment where you go, I'm waiting for Lucy to pull the football away. I'm waiting for the bipartisan thing to fall apart, and then I'm waiting for, you know, someone like Manchin or Kelly Simina. I'm going to put them both together. I'm waiting for them to kind of booger this up.
How do you deal with expectations? Do you go in with high hopes and then get disappointed, or are you going with low hopes and then get pleasantly surprised?
I'm generally the guy who goes, I live in the real world, and anything that's above the real world, I'm happy with.
Okay, I'm right there with you.
And sadly, this is the real world that we're in, and I believe in holding people accountable. So the point that I'm trying to get to is there are people that we need to be calling early and often. There are people we need to be targeting, and I think those three are a good start.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think that we have three remaining Democratic senators that have not co-sponsored the PRO Act. We've had good discussions with Mark Kelly in Arizona and Mark Warner in Virginia. Kyrsten Sinema has been tougher. It's been tougher to track her down on this. And then, there, like I said, there's an ongoing dialogue with Lisa Murkowski in Alaska. If all four of them came on, that would get us to 51 votes. And then we could make the case that the Senate rules are the only thing blocking America from having real labor law reform after 100 years.
Yeah.
At that time, we'd really need to make a full national push for Senate rules reform.
That's something we absolutely need. You guys keep up the great work. I've been watching on social media, all the places you've been, and getting out the message. Great stuff, guy.
Thanks, Rick. It's always a pleasure. We'll keep it up.
Appreciate the time. Tim Schlittner, Communications Director there at the AFL-CIO. Make sure you check out their website, aflcio.org. We'll get links out on social media, how you can follow along and see if there's something in the neighborhood near you so that you can get out and you can participate in these rallies and have your voice heard. Going to take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You'll listen to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. This day in labor history, the year was 1971. It was an historic day for the men and women who deliver the U.S. mail. It was the day that the American Postal Workers Union and the National Association of Letter Carriers signed their first ever union contract. Although there had been earlier postal unions, they did not have formal bargaining rights. Postal wages were set by Congress. This meant that the starting wage for postal workers was only $6,200 in 1970. Many of these workers actually qualified for food stamps. Frustrated at their low pay and working conditions, postal workers in New York City walked off the job. Soon, 200,000 of their fellow workers across 30 major cities joined them on the picket lines. A story in Time magazine described the impact of the work action, writing, quote, "The first national postal stoppage in U.S. history and the largest walkout ever against the federal government, the postal strike almost immediately began to strangle the operation of commerce, impair government functions, and vastly inconvenience the public." To end the strike, Congress awarded the workers a 6% raise. But even more importantly, Congress decided to reorganize the Postal Service. The Post Office Department changed its name to the United States Postal Service. With this reorganization, postal workers won for the first time the right to bargain for better wages, hours, and working conditions. Their first contract raised the starting wage to $8,488 a year, a more than 30% increase to the pay level before the strike. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So today the House approved five bipartisan measures designed to protect our cyber security space. The vote was 319-105. You go, wow, pretty overwhelming. Because look, we gotta protect our power grid. We've got to protect, our cyber infrastructure. We've got to make sure that all of the things that happen on the state and local level are protected, because we're really vulnerable. So it's good to see that, well, there is something we can agree on. There is a start. And here to share some thoughts on, well, is this a good thing, bad thing? What do we need to do to protect our country? I've asked our good friend Scott Paul to come back and share some thoughts with us. Scott is the president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing, AmericanManufacturing.org, their website. Scott, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, it is great to be with you as always.
So this is a good thing. We got five pieces of legislation, each looking at various aspects of our cybersecurity. To me, I look at this and go, why didn't you do this years ago? But I guess better late than never.
Yeah, I think, you know, it seems like everybody, whether you're an individual user or a company or a government, is always trying to catch up with what's going on in cybersecurity. And it seems like a never ending chase. But I agree. I think it's a sign of progress that Congress is taking this seriously. I think that's a step in the right direction. I also think this is an administration that takes the issue very seriously. And unlike Donald Trump, and I don't know why this is so vivid in my mind, Rick, but like, who knows if it was the Russian hackers, could have been some guy laying on his couch in the basement in New Jersey, I believe was his line. So you don't get that kind of skepticism from the Biden administration, the last administration, about foreign adversaries on cybersecurity either. And so I think all of that is very important. And I think this administration has also done a very good job of trying to work with our allies in a concerted effort to try to battle back and push back against cybersecurity threats coming from state actors like Russia and like China as well. But all of this is progress. We're playing catch up, but at least I think that more folks are taking it seriously now than certainly did 2, 3, 4 years ago.
Yeah, there was just a story the other day that I was reading about how the Biden administration and, you know, our Western allies were, you know, trying to figure out how the Microsoft Exchange email server got hacked. And they're claiming it was by China. And you go, you know, this is one of those things, again, that keeps happening and happening and happening. You know, we should have been moving on this for the last several years.
Yeah, I completely agree. And so I guess the, you know, and I have a background in security studies. And so it's always been interesting over the last couple of decades. There has been some sort of tolerance between state against state kind of like spying, right? I mean, that's kind of like considered part of diplomacy or foreign policy or whatever. But there is a line that has been crossed here. And I think that's the big issue, where you have a state actor and agents of a state actor that have its full support that are impinging on the privacy of just citizens in the United States and other countries, and stealing business secrets as well, and trying to get compromising information on people who are other than government officials. And so I think that's kind of the line that has been crossed, particularly with this Microsoft Exchange hack that we saw coming from China. And so I think that we need to speed up our defenses rapidly to that. And part of that is having good hygiene as citizens, good online hygiene as government officials doing the same. But we also need to be more punitive. There needs to be punishment. There needs to be punishment for the state actors that are committing these cybercrimes. And so that's where I think this alliance with the United States and some of our allies, particularly with respect to China, Russia, other state actors, can be quite effective as we look forward.
Now, what do you mean by online hygiene? I want to clean. I got to get the definition of that.
Yeah, it's not flossing, but you know, it's not, you know, I'm trying to. Okay, so don't open emails that seem too good to be true. Right, that's number one. You know, number two is, you know, avoid phishing if there's a link that looks a little bit off. It is a little bit off. I mean, it's like, I mean, there's a checklist that you can go through on all of this. Think before you click, basically. And so, yeah, if you're getting a great offer and you're like, oh, wow, lucky me, that's certainly not the case. It's going to be a phishing or a hacking or a spearfishing attempt. Trying to get personal or other source of information from you.
Yeah. I thought you were going the other direction of, don't share your P tapes with people. Because evidently that might actually be factual. Who knows?
Also, always a good idea, Rick.
Always a good idea because hygiene, there it is. But here's the thing, and this is what gets me. We're in this moment where we're talking about infrastructure. Almost every day infrastructure comes up. Cybersecurity should be right at the top of that list. In fact, this is a national security issue. This should also be part of our defense spending. This is stuff that should be done already, and I'm hoping that goes through. But again, this is part of our infrastructure, things that we need to make sure that we get pushed through.
Yeah, it sure is. And, just as we need to make our physical infrastructure more resilient, as we're looking at both, obviously, an aging, deteriorating set of infrastructure assets that we have in the United States, we need to build it, unfortunately, to be more climate resilient, right? And more resilient against cyber attacks. We've seen that on our electric grid already, where you've seen infiltrations of utility companies and others that operate the electric grid. And so there definitely needs to be this physical upgrade, which obviously involves a lot of building materials and everything else. But we do also need to put in place, and you're absolutely right about this, this enhanced level of protection that will help to make our country more resilient. We had, more than a decade ago now, I think, former governor and Homeland Security Secretary Tom Ridge and his team take a close look at this and what the implications were for American manufacturing. And I think that many of their findings and recommendations that they made a decade ago are now being put into place. You said, better. I think this is like years too late. And I agree, better late than never. And hopefully we'll start to catch up and our policymakers will continue to kind of get this as we move ahead.
But here's my big concern. A lot of the stuff that you need to build your cybersecurity network, made in China. We're far behind on 5G. We're far behind on a lot of the technology. We don't have enough chips. We don't have the capacity to make enough chips. It seems like we're really way behind in all of this because we've allowed corporate America to go, China's much cheaper. We can make a lot of profit over there. And it's made us much more vulnerable.
That's right. We used to make one out of every three semiconductor chips in the United States. Now it's, 10% or less. The Biden administration, I think, has an ambitious goal to push that back up. I think that's a very good thing. Senate passed some legislation to do that. We need the House of Representatives to act on that as well. And with respect to some of the other cyber tools, those need to be homegrown. Those need to be in conjunction with our allies. That's one of the reasons why I think the Biden administration has continued this policy of excluding companies like Huawei from the 5G networks in the United States, and encourage our allies to do the same. I know some people, Rick, thinks that sounds xenophobic or jingoistic, but facts are facts. This is nothing against Asian Americans, against Chinese people, but it is against a state actor, the government of China, the Chinese Communist Party, and some of its corporate functionaries like Huawei, from trying to do real damage to our economy into our security in the United States.
No, there's nothing xenophobic or racist about it. We know what the Chinese Communist government does in their country, the kind of control that they can have over technology there. What makes anyone think that they aren't, if they export that technology, that they're not going to be able in one way or another to access it? Because, the average American doesn't really know what the capacity of a lot of this electronic stuff that we're putting into our home, Alexa and Echo and all of this stuff that you're inviting into your home. You have no idea who's listening or watching.
Yeah, we take a lot for granted here in terms of privacy and security. And there's data collection. There's the ability to infiltrate that stuff. I hate to sound paranoid. I'm generally not a paranoid person, but it just makes sense to take fundamental precautions as an individual, as an enterprise or as a government. And so I'm hopeful that the Biden administration will continue to do that.
Yeah, because for me, it's a national security issue. And those issues, those concerns, I think you have to be hyper vigilant in making things at home, securing those patents and that technology in a way that it doesn't get out, that you're able to protect yourself. It just seems sane and rational to me. Now, I do want to talk with you on the bigger picture, the infrastructure plan, because there's some talk, maybe the bipartisan thing maybe might not happen. Are you hearing the same thing?
Well, look. I think there's a number of different directions where this could go over the next 24 to 48 hours. I'm someone who wants to see a robust bill passed and signed into law. There, I think, are still a number of different paths to get there. I think the legislation that the House of Representatives put forward is ambitious, is something I would obviously love to see. We do have to face the reality of the Senate here. And how do you move something through the Senate, either exclusively with Democrats or bipartisan fashion? And that may take, a little tweak here or there. I think Senator Schumer, the majority leader, was absolutely right to kind of call the question and to say, look, it's time to move forward on this. And I do think that strategy has prompted some of the Republicans who take this seriously. And I think Rob Portman from Ohio is one of these guys who does take this seriously, who wants to see something get passed to try to reach that sort of compromise that could be successful. So I don't know what's going to happen over the next 48 hours. But I do hope that we make progress, and whatever that path is, the important thing for our future, for our workers, for American manufacturing, for commuters, for equity, is to get something signed into law and to get a major investment signed into law that's going to rebuild and modernize our physical infrastructure as well as some of the digital infrastructure we've just been talking about.
No, we desperately need the investment. Now, you had Oregon Representative Peter DeFazio saying that he hopes the whole thing falls apart, that he believes that's probably going to be the best thing. Now, is that because he thinks that it isn't enough? The Senate isn't going to bring enough, and that's going to force Democrats to go much bigger? Because I did look at the fact that in the House transportation bill, they have $30 billion for climate change, climate measures. But in the Senate plan, it's only about $18 billion. So there's a huge difference because climate is going to be a big thing here in the next several years.
Yeah, it's a huge thing. I mean, you may be even getting the air quality warnings like I am from the fires in Oregon. It's stunning, and we're all the way across the country for that. And that's something that's going to continue, and it's unfortunately a very painful reminder of our new reality here. I do think that's one of the fundamental and big differences between the bills. And obviously, having a higher level of funding, investment, and focus on climate resiliency is going to be very important, as well as greenhouse gas mitigation as we move forward. And so I think that's one thing that DeFazio is talking about. I think the other thing that he's talking about is that the Senate, you got to thread the needle there, and it's very, very tough. And, are there enough Republicans who can take this seriously who are willing to pass something? I don't pretend to know the answer to that question, Rick. I do see the statements that McConnell and others have made about handing Biden a win on this. And, but I do think also that there are real honest brokers like Rob Portman who do want to see something pass. So let's call the question. Let's see if they can move this forward. And the important thing, as I mentioned, we need to get something passed for the American workers and for our future.
Yeah, and we need to do something big on climate change. I mean, the sad reality is I know there's still people who I talk to who think it's a hoax and it's not a big deal. It's just summertime. It's supposed to be hot. But we've got to do something, and in a big way. And we've got to hold China accountable. This idea that they're a developing country, I'm not buying that anymore. We can't wait for them to come around and be partners and hold hands with us. We've got to start holding ourselves and them accountable.
Yeah. I mean, look, we have a legacy to clean up here in the United States, and we should own that, and we should be responsible for it, and we should do the right thing. That doesn't mean by any measure that we should let China off the hook. In fact, China and the government needs to be held accountable. And the fact is that their industrial pollution is enormous right now because they operate very dirty factories, particularly in commodities like steel. Okay. We also have the fact that the imports that we get from China on those ships, those are heavily carbon polluting as well. All that shipping that occurs. China needs to do its fair share. So I think there are a number of mechanisms how we can do that. You know, a border adjustable carbon tax on imports, like Senator Coons from Delaware has proposed, is, I think, one way to get at that as well as to ensure that our industry isn't hurt if we put our own measures into place here in the United States. This is going to require a global solution. It's a global problem. And those actors who are currently contributing to massive greenhouse gas emissions need to play a role and to be part of the solution.
As I say it all the time, I'm a big supporter of domestic consumption, domestic production, domestic consumption. The things that we can make here that we can do for ourselves, we shouldn't be trading or being having shipped into our country because they can make it cheaper and destroy the environment. That's just insane to me.
Yeah, it is. And what gets me, and I think I'm going to go on a bit of a rant here, but economists like to say, oh, free trade, it's so efficient. It's so efficient. We're able to do this low cost and deliver this great thing for consumers. What they never consider in all of this are what I guess they would call the externalities. All of the pollution that's emitted from those ships
yep.
crossing the Pacific Ocean, or the means of production, those dirty factories in China, and the relatively large amount of carbon and greenhouse gas emissions that they're spewing. It is not right. And that's one of the reasons why you need a globalized economy that has worker-centered and climate-centered rules so that we can prosper, that we can survive, and that it isn't just about this notion of free trade at any cost, because that hasn't served us well at all.
Yep, good stuff. Scott, as always, I appreciate the time. Outstanding. Good talking to you. Thanks so much.
Likewise. Have a great evening, man.
You as well. Our good friend Scott Paul, president of the Alliance for American Manufacturing. Make sure you check out their website, AmericanManufacturing.org. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. We're right back after this.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1899. That was the day New York City newsboys went on strike. A newspaper article noted, "The Newsboys Union has decided to tie up the World and the Journal. They have struck for better rates on the evening editions of these papers, and their demands have been refused. Therefore, beginning with the first appearance of the redheaded extras this noon, the boys are going to refuse to sell. Envoys have been going up and down the line passing the word. Ye don't sell no more World or Journal, or ye get your face punched in, see?" The main issue of the strike was that the papers had sold for more money during the Spanish-American War, as people were clamoring for news of the conflict. But as the war ended, the boom dried up. The newsboys had paid more for the papers, but could not make the money back from their readers. The article quoted one of the striking newsboys saying, "They put the prices to 6 papes for a dime when the war began. Den, when the war quit and there wasn't no such sale for the papes, and we wanted to get them 2 for a cent again, but they wouldn't. That's what we're going on strike for now. The cops is all busy, and we can do any scab newsboys that show his face without police interference. We're here for our rights, and we will die defending them. At the rates they give us now, we can't make on ye 4 cents on 10 papes. The Pulitzer-owned World and the Hearst-owned Journal did not reduce prices after the war. But in the end, the newspaper's management did agree to buy back any unsold copies. And thus the strike ended on August 2nd, marking a small step forward. Labor History in Two, brought to you by the Illinois Labor History Society and The Rick Smith Show. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, and follow us on the Twitters at Labor History in Two.